Good evening and welcome behind the news for June 10, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics, back after some fundraising diversions. And got a couple of segments scheduled for tonight. First, well, I'll talk a little bit about, oh, you know who, the guy who just died, not Ray Charles either. Then we'll talk with Rick Perlstein, who is author of a very fine book, History of Barry Goldwater and the American Conservative Movement and its Emergence out of the 1960s. We'll talk to him about what Ronald Reagan did for American conservatism. And then at the bottom of the hour, excerpts of a talk that Ralph Nader gave at the Council on Foreign Relations, the heart of the establishment, at the end of May. Took about 20 minutes out of a hour presentation. We'll listen to some of what Ralph had to say, mostly about foreign policy. And thanks to all of you who pledged during my show a few weeks ago and all the other shows, too. If you haven't paid up yet, please do. We do need the money a lot. And thank you. And it's been a long time since we looked at the economic headlines, since time is short, I'll just give a quick run-through. A lot of the big numbers are looking better and stronger, firmer. The Institute for Supply Management, the survey of purchasing managers for large corporations, the people who buy stuff and who are very in tune with the state of business, they're looking strong. The employment report, which was released last Friday, showed strong job growth. We've now had a growth of nearly 1 million jobs over the last 3 months. That was really the last piece of the economic recovery puzzle. But oddly enough, consumer confidence measures seem to be weakening. The ABC Money Magazine weekly survey dropping 3 weeks in a row now to its lowest level in almost 3 months. And it's kind of hard to read. It could be that Iraq and political discontent with the Bush administration and such is weighing down on people's perceptions of the economy. Bush's ratings on the economy are actually drifting downwards. And it also may be a phenomenon that Gallup has been pointing out now for some time, which is that upscale people are perceiving the economy to be much better than people who are at less lofty levels in the social hierarchy. So it could be that this is a great economy to be rich in and a crummy economy to be not so rich in, and that may be what is being reflected in the polls, it's quite possible a lot of people are hearing all this upbeat economic news on the TV or in the radio or reading it in the papers and wondering, I don't feel that. So it could be a sign of increasing estrangement and doubt. So we'll be following this over the coming months, but big picture looking better, but down to the ground not looking so good. And, egads, how about all this Reagan worship? Revolting stuff, isn't it? You'd almost forget that he was a lying, murderous publicist for the most reactionary forces in the U.S., whose toxic inheritance we're still plagued with today. Let's have a little audio memory. This is from Reagan's first inaugural address in 1981.
But great as our tax burden is, it has not kept pace with public spending. For decades, we have piled deficit upon deficit, mortgaging our future and our children's future for the temporary convenience of the present. To continue this long trend is to guarantee tremendous social, cultural, political, and economic upheavals. You and I, as individuals, can, by borrowing, live beyond our means, but for only a limited period of time. Why, then, should we think that collectively, as a nation, we're not bound by that same limitation? We must act today in order to preserve tomorrow. And let there be no misunderstanding. We're going to begin to act beginning today.
And he got right to work, indeed, creating the biggest deficit in U.S. history since the end of World War II. Though George W. Bush is giving a good run for the money today. I do want to dissent from one standard left indictment of the man. He wasn't exactly an idiot, or was he purely an actor? Sure, he wasn't an intellectual, to put it mildly, and he was a brilliant performer at the role of the presidency. But he was more substantial than that in at least two important ways. First, he did a lot to transform American conservatism from a weird, marginal, and often misanthropic doctrine into something mainstream that partook of all the seductive idiocy of American optimism. We'll hear more about this from Rick Perlstein, who'll be on the show in a few minutes. Two economist writers, John Micklethwaite and Ingrid Woodridge, have been attracting a lot of attention for their new book, The Right Nation, Conservative Power in America. I hope to have at least one of them on the show soon. But at the moment, it's worth considering a passage from a piece they had in the Wall Street Journal on Tuesday about Reagan's brand of conservatism. As they put it, traditional conservatism was based on six principles: a suspicion of the power of the state, a preference for liberty over equality, unashamed patriotism, a belief in established institutions and hierarchies, a pessimistic backward-looking pragmatism, and elitism. That was the creed that Burke shaped into a philosophy of the 18th century, and that most famous conservatives, from Prince Metternich to Winston Churchill, understood in their bones. Mr. Reagan's conservatism exaggerated the first three of Burke's principles and contradicted the last three. Ronnie was drawn to the first three, big time, but he rejected or transformed the second three, hierarchy, pessimism, and elitism. All this was, of course, in service of an intensification of hierarchy and the increased security and prosperity of the elite, but I'm talking about public ideology, the sales pitch. Reagan was friendlier to the self-made rich of Southern California than he was to the traditional Northeastern elite that inherited their dwindling fortunes and had been the bedrock of the Republican Party in previous years. The old-line white shoe Wall Street gave way to the upstarts like Michael Milken and Carl Icahn. And Reagan had no patience for pessimism. As Micklethwaite and Woodridge put it, Churchill famously preferred the past to the present and the present to the future, but not Ronnie. He appropriated a lot of traditionally leftist language about revolution and the future, in the service of wealth and not liberation, of course, but it was a bold and transformative appropriation. And I'm sad to say the left picked up a lot of the pessimism, nostalgia, and anxiety about the future that Reagan cast off. And second, Reagan was able to finesse a lot of the divisions within the right, divisions that have opened up somewhat as the Bush administration has been stumbling, between traditionalists and libertarians, between those who worship God and those who worship money, between the paleocons and the neocons. We can debate the role of individuals in history, but it's clear that the figure Reagan contributed a lot to the popularization of right-wing ideas, and not only in the U.S., but around the world as well. We in the left have yet to recover. And now a song I've been waiting nearly a decade to play on this show. Almost from the first minute I got this show in 1995, I imagined playing this song to mark Reagan's death. I taped it about 15 years ago from Pat Duncan's WFMU show and set it aside for this very day. And here it is, the Swedish punk hardcore band The Past, doing a song called, simply enough, Ronald Reagan. And that was the Swedish band The Past doing a song called, simply enough, Ronald Reagan. And in case you missed that opening quartet of lines, Ronald Reagan is a monkey, Ronald Reagan is a donkey, Ronald Reagan is a canker, Ronald Reagan is a wanker. Ciao, Ronnie. And now we're joined on the line by Rick Perlstein, who is the author of A History of American Conservatism, which takes the form of a biography of Barry Goldwater, and is writing now currently about the U.S. presidential campaign, and is also, I believe, at work on a book about Richard Nixon. Welcome to WBAI.
All correct, Doug. Thanks.
All correct, yes. What's the title of your Goldwater book?
It's called Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus.
All right, so let's step back at history. When you were, Barry Goldwater lost terribly. He was considered a weirdo and a very marginal figure. American conservatism was, pretty marginal in those days too. Now, 40 years later, it's kind of hard to believe that. But take us back to, the 50s and early 60s, the milieu from which Goldwater emerged, and what was American conservatism like in those days?
Well, one of the famous old sort of conservative intellectuals, this fellow named Nock, called the conservative movement, he called it the remnant, kind of like this righteous remnant of people that, were the only kind of sane few in this, dominant world taken over by liberals. So there was this, not only were they kind of marginalized, this kind of martyr complex that we're so familiar with was kind of a big part of the culture even then, God, no one understands us conservatives and we're so marginalized and, we have no power. This is, what we're talking about when we say conservative are, the people who, wanted the New Deal rolled back. Actually, at that time, they weren't really these kind of militaristic expansionists. A lot of them were kind of isolationists. They were kind of a cranky crew of people in the 50s. I mean, their leaders were, I almost said Eugene McCarthy, Joe McCarthy. And, he's not, a guy that, it's very easy to be proud of if you're this kind of educated, sort of decent person. And this guy, Robert Taft, who was, a smart guy, decent guy, but really kind of a boring guy and inspired no one. Taft died. McCarthy was disgraced, thankfully, and, nothing was left. And this was kind of the low ebb. Eisenhower, the president, said, no, we got to preserve the New Deal. And he expanded it in a lot of ways. He wasn't, this kind of blood and gore, kind of militaristic conservative in a lot of ways. He gave the military-industrial complex speech, and that was kind of a low ebb for people who called themselves conservative.
And now, watching on the TV, it looks like Hillary Clinton praising Ronald Reagan in an interview. So we.
Oh, that's something I wanted to talk about. Doug.
Yeah, just let's get to that in a bit. But what was the Republican Party like in those days? It was
Well, there was kind of an idea afoot among sort of the pundit class that each party had liberals and conservatives, and this was a deeply kind of desirable thing, that the parties kind of had this ideological balance, and there was this kind of very kind of complicated set of theories, associated with people like Richard Hofstadter and Daniel Bell and kind of the liberal center, that the parties were not ideological entities. And, that was seen as kind of normatively a kind of necessary thing, because if one ideology was to capture the party, it's kind of complicated to explain why people thought this, but there was this idea that, America would turn to, these kind of fascism or extremism, basically. So, the Republican Party had plenty of liberals, not necessarily as liberal as the Democratic Party. It had plenty of conservatives. The Democratic Party, of course, had plenty of conservatives, a lot of them in the South. It had liberals, too. There were these very kind of complicated kind of cross-hatch coalitions, and the Republican Party, of course, was the party that was likely to deliver more votes for a civil rights bill in the 50s. The Democratic Party was not. And the people who kind of were in charge, who called the shots, were kind of not merely kind of these Wall Street types, but these kind of cultural sophisticates who kind of looked down their noses at kind of the heartland, and certainly didn't have this kind of solicitous kind of, sort of worship of the kind of folks, who didn't believe in the theory of evolution, to take one example.
And
the Eastern elite.
The social base of the conservative movement at that point was what, small business types?
Yeah, I think that there was kind of a big split in the 50s. I think a lot of the people who were conservatives and who kind of decided to reach for the brass ring and become more aggressive and use the Republican Party as their vehicle were people who were kind of fed up with how they saw kind of big business, kind of the GMs of the world, the GEs, had kind of sold out to the New Deal, to the labor movement. So it was kind of the smaller kind of manufacturing companies
who like low wages, it should be underscored.
Like low wages, of course, and GE and GM like low wages too, but they kind of made their peace with the unions. They weren't going to try and bust the UAW. These guys that I'm talking about, the guys who supported Barry Goldwater, they just, they wanted to see a guy like Walter Reuther kind of flatten his back in a casket. And so then, that was the class fraction, if you will.
And then in 1964, Barry Goldwater won the Republican nomination. So where did he come from, and what did he do to the party?
Well, you know, these guys who I'm talking about, and I write about this in my book, Before the Storm, basically kind of very stealthily, very cleverly, in this way that completely took the pundit class at the time by surprise, because they had, just like they do today, this kind of very set of kind of common sense wisdom that kind of their theories did not allow for this to be a possibility, kind of took over the grassroots of the Republican Party, took advantage of the nominating system of the Republican Party, you know, took over the kind of precinct committees, the people who kind of actually chose the delegates to the convention, and built this kind of disciplined army that by the time of the 64 convention was able to steal the thing right under the Republican establishment's nose and install this guy, Barry Goldwater, who, of course, a lot of us know was completely skeptical about this whole thing, completely almost indifferent to taking this position on. And yet there he was leading the party with an ideology that would be very familiar to us now, you know, get rid of the government, flat tax, go barreling in overseas with all the guns blazing, you know, the kind of conservatism we know today.
Extremism in defense of liberty is no vice. Moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue.
Right, which I kind of interpret as kind of like a 60s kind of thing, you know. I mean, the 50s really was this kind of quiescent time, kind of like today, and then maybe we can get into people like Hillary Clinton praising, you know, Reagan, in which, you know, any kind of conflict was just sort of seen as this is really a dangerous thing. And you had people not only like Goldwater, but, you know, people like, give the example of, you know, kind of Betty Friedan or Michael Harrington, or Martin Luther King, saying the enemy is this kind of centrist quiescence, this idea that we have to get along at all costs. These were all people from very different sides of the spectrum who said kind of ideology and breaking eggs to make omelets and kind of pushing for what you believe in is a noble thing in itself.
Speaking with Rick Perlstein, who is author of the book Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus. And also you're covering the presidential campaign for the Village Voice, right?
Yeah.
Barry Goldwater's name was placed in nomination by Ronald Reagan, right?
Well, that's kind of a little piece of trivia that people get wrong. It was actually placed in nomination by Richard Nixon, strangely enough. But Ronald Reagan, in October that year, the week before the election, gave a nationally televised speech that kind of had people saying, wow, this Reagan guy is great. I wish he were the candidate. And, you know, kind of gave the same kind of ideological message that Goldwater did, but, you know, just basically riffed a lot more smoothly. And people would tell me, when I would interview conservatives who were around then and working on the Goldwater campaign, they would say, geez, my friends would call me the day after that Reagan TV speech and say, geez, now I understand what this guy Goldwater was talking about. Now I understand that you conservatives aren't crazy. You know, all these kind of emotional appeals that allowed conservatism to thrive, that Barry Goldwater was very bad at conveying because he was kind of loud, kind of brash, not very smooth, kind of annoying, that Reagan being the quote-unquote great communicator. You know, like in that speech, he gave a lot of his kind of favorite kind of made-up stories. Like, he said, why should we give foreign aid so that, you know, some African potentate can buy new wives, that sort of thing. All these kind of great sort of apocryphal, silly stories that he was able to pass off as truth and kind of hustle people into believing that, you know, the government was, you know, absconding with their daughters and that sort of thing.
Now, a lot of people think, people on the left in particular, think he was kind of a cipher or just a puppet. But in some way, he was a kind of political genius in that he was capable of selling what had been a very marginal ideology. And he did it not only because he was an actor, but he also transformed the emotional content of it. Could you talk about what Reagan brought to this movement and how it went from being marginal to being very dominant?
Well, Doug, you're not gonna get me to say that Reagan succeeded because he was a sunny optimist. I mean, that's the kind of bile and bunkum that we've been fed that, you know, I think it's really important to not to buy. I mean, that's propaganda, the idea that he was a sunny optimist. I mean, he was a hateful guy. He was really good at, he would say, when he was governor of California in the 60s, he would say, well, those hippies are saying make love, not war. Well, I don't think they know how to do either. You know, that's not sunny optimism. He was also, really harsh dude.
But he said it with a smile.
Yeah, well, with a smile. But, you know, what he did was he understood messages. He understood how to meet people halfway. He understood metaphor. He understood key symbols. He understood, well, for one thing, he studied Franklin Roosevelt very carefully. That speech that he gave in 1964 had all kinds of Roosevelt kind of paraphrases. We have a rendezvous with destiny. You know, that was one of the great Roosevelt lines. He was a very smooth communicator. And, you know, I'm not saying that there was anything inherent in conservatism or conservatism as an ideology at the time. Like a lot of people do. A lot of people say, well, conservatives were negative and he made it positive. Conservatives were elitist and he made it populist. I mean, that's not my particular interpretation. My particular interpretation that he was a really suave operator that you know, practiced, worked very hard at delivering a speech that seduced people. He was extremely seductive.
He was also capable of keeping a lot of disparate factions of the right together, you know, traditionalists and libertarians and mammon worshippers and god worshippers. And was that just a force of his personality?
Well, look at the force of his personality. I mean, he's successful not only keeping these people together, but kind of beyond the grave, you know, getting these liberals to talk about what a wonderful guy he is. I mean, the liberal talking point on Reagan now seems to be, well, let's talk about how unmitigatedly wonderful Reagan was and use that to criticize Bush. You know what I'm saying?
Well, you had a piece in Salon the other day in which you said that he's not like the current gang. You're participating
in
that a little bit.
I'm not saying that that's wrong. But let's not forget that, you know, he was kind of a freak, too. I mean, he almost ended the world a couple times.
What do you make of people like Hillary and John Kerry and Bill Clinton, too?
I think this is really, really important. You know, I'm not going to be the guy, you know, I'm not here to add to the litany of awful things Reagan did. You know, everyone listening knows the awful things. What I think I can contribute to this discussion is to talk about how the idea of creating a mythology around Reagan that has certain kind of ideas at its core. One is that he was popular all the time, that he was the most beloved president, was an ideological and political project consciously carried out by people like Grover Norquist. They have the Reagan Legacy Project, you know, that's been going on for 10 years. These are the folks that want to put Reagan on the dime and stuff. And
his Gallup ratings are almost identical to Bill Clinton's. The averages and what they both went out with were almost within a point of each other.
55% average for Clinton, 53% for Reagan. And, you know, one of the things I wrote about in my piece is that I wish, you know, more people would talk about it. You don't see in the eulogies, you know, he almost got recalled a couple of times when he was governor because, you know, his popularity was down to 30% in 1968.
And he spoke against the California recall mechanism, too.
He spoke against the California recall mechanism. That's right. Even though, you know, when I went to the offices in California where they hatched this whole cockamamie idea, his picture was everywhere. And, you know, I got people saying, well, if Reagan did those things, it must have been okay. He must have had a reason. Those things being, by the way, you know, hiking taxes more than any governor had ever before. But so what we're talking about is a conscious political strategy. So whenever someone like Hillary Clinton or, you know, Al Hunt had a very kind of meretricious piece in the Wall Street Journal talking about how we really love Ronald Reagan, you know, it goes beyond ideology. That's just another way in which kind of the conservative noise machine has kind of won the battle to control mainstream opinion. Kind of call it the conservative noise machine historian wing. You know, it's like Dinesh D'Souza wrote this book about Ronald Reagan in which he literally did kind of unfurl, you know, a set of arguments that you could make about why everything Reagan did that was bad was really good. You know, everything that he did that wasn't conservative was really pragmatist. Everything that he did that was, off the wall was really sensible. He even came up with a talking point to explain why it was all right that Reagan wasn't able to recognize his own Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Do you remember that?
I remember his non-recognition, but what was so good about it?
Well, Dinesh D'Souza said that was just Reagan's brilliant way of indicating that he thought that the HUD was a sinkhole of public policy.
Ah, that's a nice. It also was his only black cabinet member, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
By
coincidence. He said, hello, Mr. Mayor.
Oh, God.
So, you know, don't believe the hype. I don't think, you know, any BAI listeners are going to be going around saying, well, maybe he wasn't such a bad guy after all. But we should understand that this really, once again, is a discussion about the quiescence of liberals and their inability to polarize discussion. And, you know, the liberals, you know, kind of deep-seated need to be kind of nice all the time and you know, kind of not break any eggs. Goldwater wouldn't approve. You know, Martin Luther King wouldn't have approved.
We've only got a couple minutes left, but is there anything we can learn from this gang?
From Reagan? Sure.
Yeah. What?
Communicate better.
Communicate better.
You know, I mean, like, learn the metaphors, learn the tropes, you know, think deeply. Learn how to manipulate fear in a way that actually, you know, gives people hope. You know, I mean, one of my big obsessions right now is people say, oh, Republicans use fear and Democrats use hope. Well, I think, like, all campaigns are based on the intelligent manipulation of fear. But people shouldn't be afraid that, you know, the terrorists are going to get them in their beds. They should be afraid that their bosses are going to screw them because, you know, they have the right to fire them at any time. You have to name people's fears in order to kind of make them hopeful and deliver yourself as the person who can ameliorate those fears. And that's what kind of Democrats and liberals don't know how to do because kind of they're too wimpy. And, you know, Reagan was not a wimp. He was a tough guy.
And we've only got like 30 seconds left, but you've been talking to a lot of people and traveling a lot covering the campaign. Do you think this this vast orchestrated episode of national mourning is going to have any legs, or is this going to peter out in a couple of weeks?
Well, I mean, I think it just shows how weak and vulnerable Bush is. I mean, they put a huge picture of Reagan in front of the Bush website. The website is filled with pictures of, you know, John Kerry in uncompromising poses. They're afraid to put Bush up on their own website. You know, I think that it's a sign of weakness. You know, I'm much more interested in mourning Ray Charles, you know, who, you know, sort of much more embodies our values. You know, he passed away, right?
Yes, we've been talking about that.
And so, yeah, I mean, I don't think that this is a net plus for the Republicans in any way. I don't think this is one of the things they're going to use to carry off the election somehow. I'm you know, optimistic about the Democrats' chances still.
They should put up that picture of Bush after he fell off his bicycle and scraped up his face. They should put that on the
cover
of the website. We don't want to be nice. I just played a nasty song about Ronald Reagan. I'm going to play another one. So thanks for joining us, Rick Perlstein.
Anytime, Doug Henwood.
And Rick Perlstein is the author of Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater, and The Unmaking of the American Consensus. He has a piece about Ronnie that went up on Salon a day or two ago and is covering the presidential campaign for the Village Voice. And now yet another nasty song about Ronald Reagan, this one, a famous one from the Ramones about his trip to Germany. That was the Ramones, their 1985 song, Bonzo Goes to Bitburg, about one of those hideous episodes of Reagan's presidency, of which there are so many. It's hard to, I don't think anybody's really mentioning in this wall-to-wall coverage that he began his 1980 presidential campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, as a gesture to, what could only be a gesture to white racists who liked what happened there. And this is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM on the radio dial, and WBAI.org on the web. And Now, another presidential candidate, this one, Ralph Nader, who spoke at the Council on Foreign Relations on May 24th, 2004. I must say, I'm not presenting this as an endorsement of Ralph. I voted for him twice in the past. I'm not going to do it again this time. But he's an intelligent fellow and worth listening to. And the irony of seeing him address the ruling class in the David Rockefeller room of the council's headquarters on the east side of Manhattan under an oil painting of David Rockefeller was really quite delicious. So here is about 20 minutes out of an hour presentation by Nader. He's introduced and then questioned by Peter Osnos, who's the publisher of Public Affairs Books. Ralph Nader.
It's been nearly 40 years, in fact, 39 years, since Ralph Nader appeared on the public scene. Very, very few people have that kind of durability. Fidel Castro, Bob Dylan, Jesse Jackson. We can take the rest of the names out in the hall for later. Mr. Nader first challenged General Motors in 1965 and created the consumer rights movement in the United States. The country has unquestionably benefited from his advocacy and that of the scores, really hundreds of young activists he trained and inspired. Now, Mr. Nader is running as an independent candidate for president and, to put it bluntly, driving many of his admirers nuts. National polls give him as much as 5% of the popular vote, which would have a decisive effect, or could have a decisive effect, on the Electoral College results in November, some people would say for the second time. Please join me in welcoming Ralph Nader, independent candidate for president.
Thank you very much, Peter, and ladies and gentlemen. To try to cover the topic that's under my rather ambitious title is best reduced to a sentence, which is how to twist the tail of the cosmos in 20 easy minutes. It's not likely to be achieved, so I hope you'll take these remarks as suggesting a change in directions and a redefinition, modestly, of foreign policy and national security and our role in the world. When I was majoring in international relations at Princeton in the mid-50s and studying a number of foreign languages, it seemed that there was a more hopeful horizon. The Korean War was over. Vietnam was not on the horizon. And we all remembered President Eisenhower's Cross of Iron speech in 1953 when he basically said, is this the way we want to have a world with massive armaments and an arms race? Isn't there another way? Looking at it from this vantage point, it seems the world's not doing very well these days. We have all the data to suggest that, although there are nice pilots of light and achievement here and there, but half of the world is living on $2 or $1 a day, and all that entails. And we certainly haven't rolled back the scourge of hunger and starvation very much, and we certainly haven't done anywhere near what we should do on disease. And our struggles with the arms trade seems to be bearing fruit primarily between us and the former Soviet Union in terms of nuclear weapons reduction, but otherwise it's proliferating all over the world in a very profitable manner with no small degree of taxpayer subsidies. Our accretions of empire seem to have grown up like Topsy. We have bases in about 100 countries. We've got troops still hanging over from World War II, defending prosperous countries in Western Europe and East Asia that are perfectly capable of defending themselves against non-existent enemies. We have almost a layer of Pompeii characteristic to our military budget. It seems that every time some new need arises, we don't replace obsolete weapons are strategically useless weapons in the pipeline. We just add more and more money so that now one half of the federal government's operating expenditures goes to military budget. One half, and we have no major state enemy left in the world. Yet we have many weapon systems in the pipeline costing hundreds of billions of dollars that were originally designed for the Soviet Union era of hostility. Without going into great detail on the situation in Iraq, a few historical points are important. First, Saddam Hussein was the U.S. government's dictator and ally against communism. We had a role with the British in the late 70s in helping him entrench himself, provide him with a list of suspected communists, which he quickly disposed of, and he was a convenient buffer against the Ayatollah regime in Iran. With our support, logistic, financial, and weaponry. He made a mistake in 1990 because he got the wrong signals from some of our diplomats and invaded Kuwait, and he became our enemy. The economic sanctions that the U.S. and the U.N. imposed were, in clear, in my judgment, violation of international law in terms of their consequence, which was the overwhelming brunt was felt by innocent civilians, including small children, who died in the hundreds of thousands, according to the American Physicians Task Force, which kept close surveillance over that situation in the 90s. That is not a bright chapter in American history, to say the least. But what was most troubling was the lack of any deliberative process by the U.S. Congress, which was stampeded into this situation, the lack of any deliberative or investigative process by the mass media, which clicked their heels and loved the graphics that they were given, and without a deliberative attentiveness to the perceived concerns of the American people. President Bush, being the messianic militarist that we've come to know so well, was not interested in meeting with anyone who was critical of his proposed Iraq policies. That was a severe scar on our democratic fabric, it seems to me. When a president plunges a nation into war without asking for a declaration of war, instead a war resolution that abandoned the congressional authority under Article 1, Section 8, and gave the president the authority to decide when and how to declare war, plunging our nation into war on what is now a very well-documented platform of fabrications, deceptions, and prevarications, to me, rises to the level of a high crime and misdemeanor and warrants impeachment proceedings to be initiated in the House of Representatives. It's hard to conceive of a more capable candidate for the invocation of the impeachment authority reposited in Congress by our Founding Fathers. Our Founding Fathers did not view Article 1, Section 8 as a technicality. James Madison believed that it represented one of the higher wisdoms of the deliberations in the creation of that document. They did not want the Declaration of War authority put in the hands of one person in the White House. They wanted it in Congress to be deliberated. How to get out of Iraq. Seems there are two futures that can be presented to the mainstream Iraqi people. One is the future that they now see before them, which is an endless, even a permanent military and corporate occupation of their country with a puppet regime in place and with no light at the end of the tunnel. There's far more resentment in Iraq about their workers being unemployed and being unable to do the work that's being done under military contract by the Halliburtons and other companies, or bringing in foreign workers while Iraqi truck drivers stand by idly. And of course, they're very concerned over the oil company takeover of their precious and almost only natural resource. That kind of future is not going to separate mainstream Iraqis from the insurgents and the resistance. It's going to increase the sympathy of mainstream Iraqis, who are the overwhelming majority, with the insurgents and the resistance. An alternative future that will separate them, distance them from the insurgencies and the resistance, would be to declare a set date for a corporate and military withdrawal by the United States from Iraq, let's say until the end of the year, with a phase-in of international peacekeepers from neutral countries who are experienced in that effort, as well as from Islamic nations. And that be correlated with internationally supervised elections to avoid any impression that a puppet regime is going to be put in place, with continued humanitarian assistance until the country gets back on its feet. That will give a stake to the mainstream Iraqi people and fortify the position of a more peaceful resolution for this reckless adventure. I want to move now to corporate globalization. This is perhaps one of the most least understood part of our foreign outreach. NAFTA and WTO are international systems of autocratic governance subordinating domestic parliaments, legislatures, agencies, and courts to the imperative of international commerce. Also subordinated by the mandate of WTO and NAFTA are environmental, consumer, and labor measures, which have to meet the test of being the least trade restrictive, and that they've chosen the most available alternative to being the least trade restrictive. This turns our progress in our country completely around. It's not only that NAFTA and WTO are autocratic and secretive institutions, off bounds in their tribunals to the media and other citizens, including the Geneva tribunals. It's not only that the decisions are made which are able to be enforced on the signatory nations in a closed courtroom with no transcript, no independent appeal, and no ability for anybody to participate other than the representatives of national governments. In other words, our state laws, which could be challenged, we cannot send state attorney generals to represent New York State in Geneva. How this monstrosity of autocracy could get through the Congress can only be explained by the fact that only one member of Congress ever read the several hundred pages of the WTO agreement before the vote was taken in 1995. As a result, the trajectory of our progress in our country, which has been marked by subordinating commercial interests to the interest of abolishing child labor, of advancing auto safety, of advancing environmental, fair labor standards, has been completely turned around by a federal law called the World Trade Organization Trade Agreement. Now, it's commerce uber alles. Now, it's a subordination of non-commercial values in human rights, labor, environment, consumer, to the imperatives of international trade. And some of the major countries like Canada, Japan, U.S., Western Europe, have put out reports annually listing all each other's laws, and there are hundreds of them, that they believe to be GATT illegal and subject to eventual challenge. I think we have to initiate our six-month withdrawal notice pursuant to renegotiating these trade agreements so they are pull-up trade agreements, not pull-down trade agreements, so they prevent child labor-produced products from being sold in international commerce when we cannot buy a product made from child labor in this country because it's illegal in this country. But it's not illegal to import products from child labor because that is permitted under the World Trade Organization rules. The third point, just briefly, in terms of redirecting and perhaps redefining our foreign relations energies, recalls the comment by William James. We need very, very strenuously in this country to have a moral equivalent of war. And we need to become a humanitarian superpower, not just because of what the word humanitarian means in our finest traditions, but also in our own enlightened self-interest and health and safety. If we look at the UN Development Program's descriptions of how little it takes to substantially reduce starvation, and diseases relating to contaminated water and other critical prerequisites of survival. It is a shame on our conscience that we cannot muster the $30 or $40 billion between the Western nations to pursue those goals that have been determined to be very practical, affecting hundreds of millions of children and poor adults in the third world. We need a major assault on the greatest weapons of mass destruction heading our way. They're called bacteria and viruses. They're called tuberculosis and AIDS and malaria and other diseases. We have no coherent national strategy. We're heading for a major pandemic from China. We need to have a major effort here to embrace the American people in foreign relations and military policy. Someone almost gets the impression in Washington that there's a rigorous attempt to exclude them, not to inform them, not to engage them, that somehow it's off limits because this is an area for expertise. Well, we know where that expertise has brought us over the years, haven't we? It's not just the best and the brightest. But we also know that there's an increasing rebellion in the establishment of foreign policy specialists and retired diplomatic and intelligence and military officials. I guess that this may be the only war we've ever been plunged into that was against the opinion, the considered opinion, of so many retired diplomats, intelligence officials, and military officers, not to mention against the considered opinion of the U.S. Army in the Pentagon and many good and sensitive people inside the CIA, the Department of Defense, and the State Department. That is perhaps a hopeful note, which is where I'll end my brief comments. Thank you.
You've said that you're running as an independent for president because the two major parties are so closely aligned on policy. And yet the prevailing, or at least the widespread view in the country, is that we're more polarized in many respects than we've been in a generation. So the real question is, do you think the parties are really indistinguishable, or are we polarized? How do you reconcile the paradox?
Both. I mean, they are polarized in certain social issues, which we all know about. For example, pro-choice, pro-life. They're polarized on access to the civil justice system. There are significant differences on Social Security and Medicare. But on the fundamental issues that affect the future of democracy, they're on the same page. They're selling elections to the highest bidder. They've corrupted our politics by depending more and more on money. That, of course, rolls over in terms of government. And they're unwilling to challenge the sovereignty of giant corporations over the sovereignty of the people. And to me, that's on the same page on the basic structural prerequisites of plutocracy. Well, I was asked the question, is he presidential? What am I going to say?
You could have said he's a schlub. You said that George Bush should be impeached.
Yes. But he was asking almost a physical appearance question.
In this coming election, how specifically, since you are so against the Iraq policy and the Bush administration in general, how specifically do you see your candidacy as helping to defeat Bush rather than helping to defeat Kerry? I don't quite see the mechanics of that.
Well, let me explain it again in a different manner. The members of the party out of power usually come back into the fold in the next election. It's the members of the party in power that have the luxury of fury. And there's a lot to make conservatives and liberal Republicans and independents who normally vote Republican furious with the Bush administration, furious on the massive deficit, furious on their taxes going to corporate subsidies, furious on Big Government Patriot Act, furious on sovereignty shrinking WTO and NAFTA, and even furious on the corporate crime wave, and they lost their 401ks too. Now, all these examples are ones we've worked on. All these examples are in the conservative literature of protest that's building up against Bush. So whether to encourage them to remain home or to vote for this independent candidacy, I'm pretty persuaded, given the wholesale abandonment of liberals such as you from any possibility of voting for this candidacy, that will take more votes away from voters that otherwise would have voted for Bush. We have been completely abandoned by liberals, and I say to them, fine, you go vote for Kerry. Bring all your liberal friends and vote for Kerry. It's a big country out there. There are 100 million voters in this country who don't vote. Let's try to scramble for some of them.
You know, when I started, we've got to stop. I did make a comparison between you and Fidel Castro. I saw the other day that his doctor said he's going to live to 140, which I think on that basis, Ralph, gives you a hell of a good long run. So thank you very much for coming to the Council.
And that last voice was that of Peter Osnos, the publisher of Public Affairs Books. Most of the voice you heard in that last 20 minutes or so was of Ralph Nader speaking before the Council on Foreign Relations on the east side of Manhattan on May 24th, 2004. And you can see the full transcript of the talk and the Q&A on the Council on Foreign Relations website, cfr.org. And you can see, I think it's videos and transcripts is a selection up at the top of the screen on the front page, cfr.org. And Nader is a little bit of the ways down. They have a lot of actions there. Just a couple of comments on all that. First of all, I would want to say that Ralph said many, many good things in that talk, but it's not just what an individual candidate says that matters. It's a long-term political organization, and I'm afraid we haven't seen that much of it coming out of him. He is now running his third rather lone wolfish candidacy for the presidency with little institutional development to show for it, and that's really not the way to challenge the ruling class in a significant way over the longer term. And just a dissent from a couple of the odder things he said. When he's talking about the WTO and NAFTA, as a result, the trajectory of our progress in our country, which has been marked by subordinating commercial interests, and I don't know what he is talking about in that regard. We've had commercial interests at the center of our national obsessions for a couple of centuries, as far as I can tell. And I don't know what trajectory of progress he's talking about that was interrupted by the creation of the WTO or by NAFTA, which are both about 7 or 10 years old. And it seemed like we started undoing the New Deal in about 1981 when Ronald Reagan became president. So I really don't know what he's talking about there. Also, you know, is the subordination of U.S. interest to an international body entirely a bad thing on the face of it? We certainly have an awful lot of U.S. Power in the world, and maybe it's nice to have that sometimes constrained by a little multilateral organization now and then. I also have no idea what he's talking about with a major pandemic from China. That sounds a little bit like yellow peril-ism rewritten for the 2004. I guess that's about it for my comments on Ralph Nader. But anyway, if you want to read the full transcript again, you can visit the Council on Foreign Relations website, cfr.org. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I think I'm preempted next week for a 9/11 commission, although it's supposed to be over by 5, so I don't quite understand the scheduling of that. But in any case, let's go out with another musical memorial to Ronald Reagan, this by the British band Heaven 17, which, judging from the textual evidence, was written and recorded probably in December of 1980 because Ronald Reagan is the president-elect. And stay tuned for the news and on into the evening and back whenever. This is Doug Henwood. Goodbye.
Democrats are out of power across the blue wide ocean. Reagan's president-elect. Fascists got in motion. Generals tell him what to do. Stop your good time dancing. Train their games on me and you. Fascists take advancing. Sisters, brothers, lend a hand. Increase our population. Grab everything by the throat and throw it in the ocean. You're real tonight, you move my soul. Let's cruise on at the dance floor. Come out your hands and dance your dance. Shake that fascist groove thing. Colors, Sisters, we don't need a nice group day. Brothers, sisters, we don't need a nice group day. Brothers, sisters, we don't need a nice group day. Brothers, sisters, we don't need a nice group day.